Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Top comedians are on stage at a big comedy festival in Saudi Arabia. Critics call it whitewashing the kingdom's abysmal human rights record.
They are trying to promote this festival that, for me, itself is a joke.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, businesses closing, people leaving the country, President Trump's crackdown and its many impacts on immigrant communities.
I had kids that were not going to school for weeks because their parents were afraid of an ICE crackdown at school.
Plus, an update on the Gaza flotilla intercepted by the Israeli military, and why four Caribbean nations are opening their borders to each other.
The quest to improve standard of living is a feature of our economies for decades.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday. We start today in Manchester, England, where an attacker killed two people and injured four others outside of a synagogue filled with worshippers. Police said they shot and killed the suspect and that they're treating the incident as an act of terrorism.
Today is Yom Kippur, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer cut short a trip to Denmark to put together an emergency security meeting in London. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry is following the story. Details are still emerging, Orla, about what exactly happened today, but what do we know so far?
Yeah, there's some elements that we still don't know, including the identity of the attacker or indeed the motive for the attack. What we do know is that the synagogue, it's an Orthodox synagogue. It's in Crumpsall in North Manchester, which is a residential area, sort of a leafy area. A multicultural community live there, including a large Jewish community. And at around 9:30 this morning, police got reports that a man had driven a car towards members of the public just outside the synagogue. He then got out of the car, we understand, with a knife and injured people, then tried to get into the synagogue but was stopped by fellow worshippers. There had been reports that he had explosives strapped to his body, and there's a video from the scene where you can hear police shouting at bystanders, stand back, he has a bomb, stand back. He was subsequently shot dead by the armed officers, and the police said this evening that the device was not viable, that he had strapped to his body was not viable. They believe they have identified who he is, but they are not releasing details as of yet. But all we know is that they are treating it as a terrorist attack.
So there has been reaction from across the political spectrum and from a variety of religious communities. What have people been saying?
That's right. The leaders of the four main political parties in Britain have come out condemning the attack. Keir Starmer said he'd deploy all police assets to synagogues across the country, that he'd do everything to keep the Jewish community safe. Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the opposition Conservative Party, she called it a vile and disgusting attack today and said members of the Jewish community deserve to know they're not alone. Huge responses from across Europe, from the Danish Prime Minister to the French President. The reaction from the Jewish community itself has been relatively muted because it is Yom Kippur, this very holy day. It's a day of atonement and reflection and prayer, and observant Jews usually refrain from all forms of work, which is supposed to include using electronic devices like phones or computers and indeed doing interviews. So we haven't seen Jewish leaders coming out giving interviews today. What we did see was a statement from the Jewish Representative Council of Greater Manchester this morning, saying this is an event that every Jewish person in Britain had feared. This is the culmination of 2 years of constant Jew hatred targeting our community by those who wish to attack us because of the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. And one other statement of response, Marco, was from the British Muslim Network, and they said the bloodshed and violence in the Middle East, which is excruciatingly painful to witness for all of us, must not be allowed to poison our streets in Britain.
Orla, as to that commitment to stepping up security at synagogues across Britain, is that happening now?
It is, we understand. Keir Starmer said earlier he'd see that it would happen, and the head of counter-terrorism police, Lawrence Taylor, made a statement about it a short time ago.
Police forces are stepping up patrols across the country, at synagogues and Jewish sites, and more widely to provide reassurance to all those communities who have been affected by this incident. At Counter-Terrorism Police, we're deploying all of our capabilities in response to what has happened. And we have resources from across our network involved. We will ensure every piece of intelligence and line of inquiry is interrogated.
We know, by the way, the security had already been increased at synagogues over the past 2 years. I mean, most synagogues have their own private security guards in place. And in fact, as the incident was unfolding this morning in Manchester, across the UK, synagogues got an alert warning them of the attack and to be on alert themselves. Now, we haven't heard anything since then of any incident at any other synagogue. So it seems that this man may have acted alone.
So on guard for a few years. But interestingly, this incident is the worst fatal attack on a synagogue in the UK in a very long time. But let's remember that anti-Semitic attacks have been on the rise on the continent since October 7th and Hamas's attack on Israel almost exactly 2 years ago. What more is there to say, though, Orla, about anti-Semitism in the UK today?
I mean, we know the last 2 years, 2023, 2024, have been some of the worst years for anti-Semitic attacks in the UK. And I mean, the Jewish community, by the way, in the UK, it's actually quite a small community. You're talking about maybe around 300,000 people in terms of the UK's population. That's just around 0.5% of the population. Mm. And I was looking at the figures earlier from the Community Security Trust. They're a charity who monitor anti-Semitism in the UK. And they said in the years, say, 2015 to 2022, you had an average of around 130 incidents each month. Last year and the year before that, that number doubled and in some cases tripled. And, you know, the incidents went from physical attacks and property damage to online abuse and then incidents of extreme violence. But I was listening to a Jewish author this afternoon who was saying a lot of people he now knows, they will regularly, when they go out, they will remove their Jewish symbols when they go outside because they fear an attack. And one message I heard repeatedly from members of the community who would speak to me off the record, but not on the record because of the day that's in it, said that there was a sense of inevitability, that an attack like this would happen, that they knew it was coming, and that they just felt the government or the authorities in the UK just weren't paying enough attention to the concerns.
The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry bringing us the latest on the attack on a synagogue in Manchester, England today, leaving two people dead and several others seriously injured. Orla, many thanks.
You're welcome, Marco.
A historic agreement on the freedom of movement went into effect yesterday in four Caribbean nations. People from Barbados can now pack up their lives and move to Belize or Dominica or St. Vincent and the Grenadines. People in four Caribbean countries no longer need a visa or residency permit to live within that group. Rosalia Hamilton is the founding director of Jamaica's Institute of Law and Economics in Kingston. She said programs for skilled workers, graduates, and artists began back in the 90s. But this is the first time this will apply to everyone.
This discussion and this development is long in coming, and I'm very pleased to see it. I think it's a great idea to pilot this regional integration arrangement for four countries, less than 1 million people. So, you know, it's a small group of individuals who will be moving around. And I think this unfettered movement of these four countries is a very important move in the right direction. And we'll just see if it lives up to all that's promised.
And why these four specific countries?
I think a lot has to do with the leadership in these countries. I think these leaders felt that it is time. We've been talking about it for too long. And very importantly, there was a decision made in 2023 at the CARICOM Heads of Government meeting.
CARICOM is the Association of Caribbean Nations.
Absolutely, our Caribbean Common Market. And there was an agreement for all CARICOM nationals to move by March 2024. Some countries have been, you know, delaying it. In the case of Jamaica, it's been delayed for legislative procedural considerations, but other countries have delayed for different reasons. But these four countries felt ready and they've decided to move ahead.
And what is the goal of doing this? What problem is this trying to solve?
There regionalism is a very important development, especially now in the context of what seems to be a breakdown and a decline in the multilateral arrangements in the world. And I think what it definitely offers is the building blocks for global cooperation. It's very, very important for small economies like ours, where we have to know how to collaborate even with our differences. And the tighter and the deeper the integration gives us a better understanding of who we are, how to manage conflicts, and importantly, to strengthen our voice in an increasingly polarized world in which small voices can easily get trumped. So it's very, very important that we strengthen our voice so that we can have a greater say in global dynamics.
I'm a little surprised that you didn't mention the economy. I mean, I would imagine that this means the movement of business, of workers, of consumption and money. Is there expected economic impact from this plan?
Absolutely. And in fact, the movements enables countries to fill gaps that exist in the labor market that is going to facilitate development. However, my own view is that the economic development that we want will go way beyond free movement of people. It has to tackle issues having to do with increasing productivity, the increase in the skill level. In some of our countries, we're still seeing the labor force underskilled in a globally competitive world that requires high skills. And so the movement of people is one small step in a much larger conversation about what is required to develop these countries. Remember, these countries have come out of a history of extraction and a trading arrangement that is highly import dependent. And so an important part of the development process has to be how to deepen the productivity of countries to be able to produce globally competitive goods and services that ultimately can redefine that trade imbalance.
Are there countries worried about losing some of their population, like migration away from weaker economies to stronger ones?
Well, you know, if you look at the data, the entire Caribbean region, including Guyana, that is doing very well, has seen for decades high immigration rates. I mean, people migrate regularly. In fact, that has been a trend since emancipation.
So migrating out of the region.
Out of the region in search for lifting the standard of living. Now, the standard of living in the region is very complex and uneven. And so the quest to improve standard of living is a feature of our economies for decades. And so I think one of the objectives and the opportunities we have in the regional arrangements is to improve standard of living as people move around within the territories, especially within those territories in which the GDP per capita is much higher.
So is the idea that this eventually might be expanded to the entire Caribbean region?
Well, that's the agreement made in July 2023, absolutely, that it's free movement for all CARICOM nationals. And so the question of when it will be formalized is really the issue. And I think these four countries really are just setting the pace.
Rosalia Hamilton is the founding director of Jamaica's Institute of Law and Economics in Kingston, Jamaica.
There's good news and bad for Japan's Asahi Brewery. On the plus side, the company is expanding European distribution of its massively popular super dry beer. That's according to the Japan Times. The beer will be produced in Italy starting soon and in the UK by the winter.
The bummer news, that same beer is about to be impossible to find inside Japan because of a cyber attack on the company. The Financial Times reports that hackers have disabled most of Asahi's 30 factories in Japan, and the company has not been able to deliver beer to retailers since Monday. giving super dry a whole new meaning.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Greenland is a place where a lot is dependent on the weather. For example, getting around. Most of Greenland is covered in a mile-thick sheet of ice, so most people live in small communities along the coastline. To get from village to village, you can fly, if the winds are cooperating when you have to take a helicopter. In the winter, if the sea ice is frozen enough, you can take a snowmobile or dog sled. And in summer, if the sea ice is thawed enough, you can take a boat. But even in August, you'll be hitting small chunks of ice.
Weather always decides where we can go and when we can go.
This is Frederik Vill, who lives in a village of about 200 people in East Greenland.
Weather is very much part of our lives. We have to respect weather here.
And the weather is changing. Most of Greenland is above the Arctic Circle, a region scientists say is warming about four times faster than anywhere else on the planet. I wanted to see how life is changing there and how people are adapting. So in August, I traveled to a couple of communities perched on the fjords in remote southeast Greenland. My welcome to the waters off of East Greenland has come from two whales. They're diving to feed here off the coast of a small village and surfacing to breathe. It's probably a mother and a calf. They are here for the same reason humans first settled here: access to food.
We are hunters. We have a saying here that without seals, there would be no life here in Greenland.
Frederik Vill shows me into a small museum he runs with his wife.
I can give you a small tour in here.
It's housed in an old post office up the hill from where I spotted those whales. And he shows me a seal skin. The seal skin is beautiful. Are they leopard seals?
No. Here is the number one seal for Inuit. This one we call Miketek, the small one.
That's something he has hunted when he's not working as a schoolteacher. On a mannequin in front of us are the furry white pants he used to wear on his dog sled when the sea ice had frozen over in the winter.
20 years ago, it would be normal season for winter. Thick ice, safe ice, a lot of ice. We could go long distances, south, north, anywhere in wintertime, then it would be safe. But now, ice just getting thinner and thinner and smaller in area. So it has changed so much just in 20 years.
The sea ice used to be safe to travel and hunt on from about December until June, he said. Now it's more like January to April. Wind storms seem to be getting more intense, he and others tell me. And snow, he says, is getting less reliable.
Warmer climate means also usually we have so much snow during winter. But now very often we see rain in winter here, which long time ago was not usual.
These changes in weather are contributing to a cascade of other changes. Dog sleds are used to get around and to hunt seals. In fact, Greenlandic sled dogs are so important to the culture here that it is illegal to bring in any other kind of dog to many parts of Greenland to protect the breed. I go to visit dozens of them. They look like huskies.
All these sled dogs in town are kept just a little bit outside of town on a rocky hillside along the fjord. They're chained up here with their packs.
Keeping these dogs is expensive, though, and as the sea ice season shrinks and snowmobiles become more common, the number of sled dogs in Greenland has gone down by about half over the last 20 years. Frederik Vill has already retired his pack.
I used to have 10, 11, 12 dogs, but I stopped having dogs maybe 5 years ago.
Why did you stop keeping dogs?
Like I said about the climate changing, I couldn't go far. I couldn't go for many months, so I stopped.
In the regional capital of Tasiilaq, population about 2,000, Parliament member Eustace Hansen tells me that Greenlanders know the climate is changing.
We feel it every day, and the local people know that. They're adapting, and we are adapting also. And there's a transition now from hunting to fishing.
The government offers loans so locals can more easily buy fishing boats. And down the hill from the municipal building where Henson has his office...
This is the brand new fish processing plant built on the harbor. Still doing some construction work here.
The warehouse-sized plant processes mostly cod caught by local fishermen who keep boats in slips just a few feet away. Some warmer water species like mackerel are starting to show up in Greenland's waters, which could open up new fishing opportunities. But climate change is having other impacts here that could eventually lead to a reduction in sea life. The glaciers that flow into the fjords help make the waters here particularly productive, teeming with life. But if the glaciers retreat enough because of warming temperatures, that could end. Lawrence Mara is a senior scientist at the Greenland Climate Research Center.
Over geological timescales, we have fjords where the glaciers have completely melted and have disappeared. And in these fjords, we often see that like productivity is much less because there's not this mechanism to keep like bringing nutrients to the surface layer during the summer periods.
And one of the glaciers up the fjord from us right now is likely to stop flowing into water in the next few decades.
Yeah, likely. And based on that, I would expect that this fjord branch will become a lot less productive. And that will likely lead to the fact that there will be less fish and seal moving in to feed on this rich ecosystem which is there.
This is a big deal.
For many people, it's indeed their livelihood. So therefore, it's really important to understand what's going on with these fjords, with these glaciers.
Walking out of the museum up on the hill, Frederik Vill and I run into his wife on the road. Earlier, he'd shown me a picture of her mother, who's 80 now, but lived in a turf house when she was little.
And they were living in the old way, like in the Stone Age way.
Change has come very fast here, he tells me, especially as the planet warms.
In East Greenland is fastest in the world. Always we try to adapt, but I think I'm a bit worried. I see it getting just only powerful, more strong wind, strong storm. It's not nice.
As he says this, he makes a sharp upward motion with his hand, like a plane taking off. What climate change looks like to him. Our extensive reporting on climate change and how people around the globe are dealing with it is online at theworld.org.
American comedians have been drawing a lot of attention for performing at a comedy festival in Saudi Arabia. Just ahead, a Saudi dissident explains why the festival is not funny. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Saudi Arabia's capital city, the first ever Riyadh Comedy Festival is in full swing. It's been promoted as the biggest comedy event in the world. Aziz Ansari, British comic Jimmy Carr, Dave Chappelle, and Whitney Cummings, just a few of the well-known names who are part of it. On his Monday morning podcast this week, Bill Burr described performing in front of the Saudi royal family and called the festival a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
It was a mind-blowing experience. Definitely top three experiences I've ever had.
But it's not been all laughs. Human rights groups say the comedy festival is being used to whitewash the Saudi government's notorious human rights abuses. There's also been criticism from inside the comedy world, like these thoughts from Marc Maron.
I mean, how do you even promote that? You know, like, from the folks that brought you 9/11, 2 weeks of laughter in the desert. Don't miss it!
To dig deeper into all of this, we reached out to Abdullah Al-Oda. He's the senior director on countering authoritarianism at the Middle East Democracy Center in Washington. Al-Oda is from Saudi Arabia, and as we'll hear, his fierce criticism of this comedy festival is rooted in human rights abuses that persist in Saudi Arabia, which his own friends and family have experienced.
One major difference between these kind of festivals and the festivals where you see elsewhere is that this festival is completely sponsored by the Saudi government. It's part of their whitewashing machine that started since the Khashoggi murder.
Journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Yes. Journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed and dismembered at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul exactly 7 years ago. And this is the irony here. The Saudi government did not take a joke from Khashoggi. The Saudi government did not take a joke from Turki al-Jasir, who was executed just 2 months ago because he ran a cynical account on Twitter, and they did not take a joke from Abdurrahman Sadhan, who was sentenced to 20 years in prison because also he ran another parody account because he was making fun of the Saudi government. My own father, one of the charges against him in court was that mocking the government achievements. So this is a government that did not take any of these jokes. And now it seems like they are trying to promote this festival that for me itself is a joke. I think it's mind-blowing and ironic.
So obviously very personal for you, as you just suggested. I want to come back to your father's situation in a moment. But just a clarification, what did you mean the Saudi government did not take Khashoggi's joke?
Yeah, when Khashoggi criticized the Saudi government, Khashoggi talked about, quote unquote, the supreme leaders of Saudi Arabia. He was making a joke and comparing what MBS does.
Mohammed bin Salman.
Yeah, to other tyrannical leaders around the world. So that's the irony here. We are exactly marking the 7th anniversary of his murder by the same regime and the same folks who actually right now is hosting this event.
So Bill Burr, whom we heard from a moment ago, glowing about a set he did for the Saudi royal family, he said that comedians were being told by organizers that they can joke about almost anything at the festival besides religion and the royal family. So call it free expression light. But even so, doesn't that suggest things are changing in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think what's changing is that they have been embraced because of money. I think one of the most honest things that I've heard about this festival is what Tim Dillon said before he was pulled out from the festival, when he said, I'm taking it only for money, not that I like or I admire anything that the Saudi government does. You know, he said, it's the money. He said they doubled the amount that I get elsewhere, sometimes tripled that.
So essentially saying, I'm only in it for the money, as you said, that came from Tim Dillon, an American comedian. It's also something a lot of comedians at the festival have said, but they're not all getting pulled, though, are they?
Well, the thing is, like, the other comedians, they did not expose the whole scheme of doing this for the whitewashing of the whole thing. It doesn't please me to say that, but other comedians have not been as honest to the people about this. Even when they mention this, they try to make it like it's a principled stance, try to talk about, oh, understanding other cultures or the people or whatever. The thing is, if you want to do this as part of understanding other cultures, well, include the Saudi people, talk about the Saudi people who have been executed, well, show us that you care about other cultures and other people by talking about the people who are imprisoned for life, because saying jokes like you do. Fahad al-Bateri was actually kidnapped by Saudi forces from Jordan because his wife dared to drive in Saudi Arabia. And he was one of the most followed and popular comedians in 2018. That's the kind of government they're promoting right now, to be honest.
So, as you explained earlier, this is very personal for you. Your father, as you said, is in prison in Saudi Arabia, accused of, quote, inflaming society against the rulers and stirring up unrest. The UN has described your father as someone with respect for human rights within Islamic law. He's been in jail since 2017. He could face execution. What is the current situation for him?
Well, he's still in solitary confinement. He has been there for 8 years. This is torture according to international standards. 19 members of my family are banned from traveling just to retaliate against my activism and my vocal speaking up against the Saudi government and their violations. They tortured him. They deprived him from sleep, from medication. They still mistreat him. And he lost half of his vision and half of his hearing because of the mistreatment and medical negligence. Now, 8 years later, we're still in the same situation.
Saudi Arabia has also hosted major sporting events and entertainment like concerts. Again, charges of whitewashing. Do you think these sorts of things, though, could help change Saudi society for the better?
Well, I think it's, of course, attended by a lot of people. People like sports. That's ordinary. That's normal. What's not ordinary or normal is that all of these events are completely and directly controlled, administered, and manipulated by the Saudi government and used, you know, to whitewash the crimes locally and internationally. I'll give you just a quick example about this. All of these actually sports events and many of these cultural events are controlled and owned by the public investment fund, the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, that actually has a subsidiary called Prime Aviation, used in 2018 to fly the team that actually killed and dismembered our friend Jamal Khashoggi 7 years ago. This public investment fund is not just whitewashing the crimes, it's committing the crimes and then whitewashing it afterwards.
I'm also curious, like, who is the audience? What are the politics or social backgrounds of people attending the comedy festival in Riyadh?
Well, generally a wide range of people, from ordinary people like me, of course, and people who are from higher up, go there to have fun. And to be honest, that's understandable. It's upon these comedians to set up a moral stance, to say the right things. And if they had to do it anyway, at least say something that can uplift the spirit of the people who are oppressed. Say something that defends the Saudi people.
So when you say, Abdullah, the audience might be people like me, safe to say you would not, could not attend for your own safety, given your criticism of the Saudi government, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I cannot go back to Saudi Arabia. They want me to go back. I cannot go back because of all the, of course, the security concerns. There was a point where actually the Saudi embassy here in Washington, in order to lure me to going back, they offered me a free ticket. They said it's just to discuss some matters and come back to the U.S., but they only offered a one-way ticket.
Wow.
I could see through that. And this, by the way, was only weeks after the Khashoggi murder, just to show you that the Khashoggi event is not a one-off operation. It's a pattern.
How safe do you feel living in the U.S. and criticizing the Saudi government?
Well, I think I'm safe here. And to be honest, I have made my decision to not be preoccupied with fear, because that's what the Saudi government want to inflict on me. I think I will just serve their purposes if I stay silent, because that's what they wanted, is to intimidate me into silence. I think what they did to my friend Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul 7 years ago today is a way to send a message to everyone who does what Khashoggi did, in order to say, well, that's what you get. And what we want to say back is that, well, this is not going to intimidate us into silence.
I ask also partly because freedom of speech is at the very least being hotly debated in the U.S. right now, and at the worst, some say, under severe threat. Do you see a connection?
Absolutely. It's actually ironic and even contradictory to see that these comedians, who rightly so condemned the pulling out of the Kimmel show for a week as an attack on free speech, and I totally applaud their stance on this. It's the right principle stance to do. They are going to Saudi Arabia, one of the most repressive regimes on earth, promoted by the Saudi government, the very team that executed a record number of people in the history of the Arabian Peninsula, who commits so many crimes against so many people in Saudi Arabia, including my family and myself. And then they try to make, quote unquote, a safe joke that does not talk about things that the government of Saudi Arabia does not like.
Abdullah, how much of a comedy fan are you?
I like comedy a lot. I watch, to be honest, a lot of the people who went to Saudi Arabia. And to be honest, it's very sad and unfortunate to see the people that I like and I follow, and I watch a lot of their clips, go over there and talk to the person who tortured us and who executed people we know, went after our family, intimidated us, and killed Khashoggi 7 years ago without even saying a word about any of these events or anything related to human rights.
Can you ever watch these performers in the same way again?
No, I cannot do that anymore. I was only last week trying to see if any of them mentioned anything related to things that the Saudi people care about, things that the people of Saudi Arabia suffered from. Yes, of course, we are allowed to laugh. We want to laugh. The people want to laugh. The thing is, like, it's different when you make the people who torture us laugh and when you take a joke at them. That's the huge difference between this, is to speak to power or to speak on behalf of power, to be part of the royal agenda or to have a principled stand that makes jokes at everything that you think is critical to make fun of.
Abdullah Aloda is with the Middle East Democracy Center in Washington.
The Israeli military has stopped a large aid flotilla with dozens of boats and more than 400 activists that was heading toward the shores of the Gaza Strip. Live-streamed videos showed Israeli forces boarding boats and detaining passengers and crew. They were ferried to an Israeli port, and the government there says it will now deport them. The Samud flotilla left from Barcelona over a month ago. Their goal was to break Israel's naval blockade of Gaza and deliver food and medicine to Palestinians there. From Barcelona, the world's Jerry Haddon reports.
Everyone on board the Samud flotilla knew their odyssey would end more or less like this. Israeli naval vessels surrounded the boats in the dark last night, ordering the activists to cut their engines. This boat refused, so the Israelis opened fire with water. Water cannons.
So
the Samud isn't the first flotilla to try to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza, but it is the largest ever, as has been Israel's response. Some 600 police were sent to wait on land, along with several ambulances, according to Israeli television. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government said all along it would stop the flotilla, as it has with others over the years. But there's a covert side to this story, too. Someone, a group, a state, tried repeatedly to impede the activists' advance, starting in early September. One night in a Tunisian port, a flaming object suddenly dropped onto the deck of the flotilla's lead ship, the Alma, starting a fire. Startled activists scream for help, all of this captured by the ship's own security video.
Which boat was that?
Flotilla leaders say they suffered a total of 11 attacks by drones dropping flash grenades and other devices. Someone was jamming their communications regularly, too. No one has claimed responsibility for any of those incidents, but via Instagram, activist Tiago Avila from Brazil pointed his sextant toward Tel Aviv.
We know who use quadcopter drones with explosive devices and who really hates the idea of a humanitarian mission trying to stop children from starving to death in Gaza.
For its part, the Israeli government has said it has uncovered documents linking the flotilla to Hamas. So far, it hasn't presented evidence of this. In the past, the government has dismissed similar flotillas as mere publicity stunts.
It's basically, if you will, a floating news hook.
This is Andreas Kriegs, associate professor of security studies at King's College London. He studies flotilla activism and its symbolic power.
You've got celebrities, MPs and activists on, you know, 40 to 50 small civilian boats, live streaming a confrontation everyone is expecting. That combination keeps Gaza on the front page.
That attention, he says, helps force governments' hands, especially in nearby Europe. Spain sent a military rescue vessel to shadow the flotilla. So did Turkey and Italy. But as the flotilla neared the Gazan coast and confrontation with Israel, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni sounded a less supportive note. She called the flotilla's mission dangerous and irresponsible.
Non c'è bisogno di rischiare la propria incolumità.
There is no need to risk your own safety, she said. No need to slip into a theater of war to deliver aid to Gaza. Aid that the Italian government and the authorities in charge could have delivered in a few hours. Andreas Krieg points out that the supplies on the Samud flotilla's 47 pleasure boats would barely make a dent in a population of hungry millions. Strategically speaking, he also doubts whether this latest effort to break Israel's naval blockade of Gaza will cause Israel to change tack.
The outcome really depends on, you know, whether the international community in particular will want to take more than just condemnation and verbal pressure and put, you know, additional pressures on Israel, which I don't think is going to happen.
But the Samud flotilla activists appeared undeterred up to the last minute. As activists braced for the long-awaited seizure of their boats, Italian Tony Lapicciarelli posted this brief message on Instagram. We tried, he said. Now it's your turn. Block everything. That's a reference to a new grassroots protest movement in France. The flotilla activists hope that by linking their campaign to others, they'll keep Gaza and the plight of Palestinians in the public consciousness. For the moment, at least, it seems to be working. Today, Colombia cut all diplomatic and trade ties with Israel. In Italy, workers went on strike to protest the flotilla's interception. Turkey called Israel's actions at sea terrorism. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Barcelona.
Up next, Brazilian immigrants, including some who like President Trump, reckon with immigration raids in their community. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
A massive late-night immigration raid in Chicago this week involved drones, helicopters, and some 300 federal agents. Snipers rappelled onto the roof of an apartment building, according to the New York Times. One witness told WBZ in Chicago that agents dragged children outside who were, quote, buck naked and taken from their mothers. The Department of Homeland Security said 37 people were arrested in that raid.
For months now, President Trump's immigration crackdown has sent waves of fear through different communities across the U.S. In Massachusetts, people from Brazil are the largest immigrant group in the state. As Philip Martin from GBH Boston reports, Brazilians are being detained in larger numbers by federal agents since Trump began his second term in office.
On a recent Saturday afternoon on Main Street in Marlboro, only a sprinkling of people are going in and out of normally bustling Brazilian cafes and shops.
I think a good indicator of the Brazilian community is how many Brazilian bakeries, restaurants, shops that you see.
27-year-old Renata Nunes was raised in the suburban city that is one of the largest concentrations of Brazilians in the state. Now, she says, she is seeing fewer people at cafes, shops, and bakeries owned by Brazilian entrepreneurs. Until recently, she worked at a charter school in nearby Framingham with a majority Brazilian student body. A lot has changed in a year, she says.
I had kids that were not going to school for weeks because their parents were afraid of an ice crackdown at the school. And also the estheticians, the people at the salon that we know, the contractors that we know, some of them haven't been going to work. When they do go to work, they take a lot of precautions. They're always checking their surroundings.
There's an estimated 140,000 Brazilians in the state. The majority are foreign-born, research shows. Now, they are also being picked up by federal agents in larger numbers. Since January, some 780 people from Brazil were apprehended by federal agents, about a quarter of all immigrants detained this year, according to the nonprofit Deportation Data Project. That's nearly three times as many as all Brazilians who were detained in the state last year, data shows. Why Brazilians in Massachusetts are being targeted is no mystery, says Graham Blair of the Data Project. He says as the largest non-citizen population in the state, they are easy pickings for ICE, which needs to fill a daily quota.
I think what we're seeing is that the Trump administration is looking across the country at the way that it can arrest, detain, and deport the most number of people in the shortest amount of time.
It's creating panic in this Portuguese-speaking community. One flight up a set of creaky wooden stairs of this graffiti-marked building, Executive Director Lenita Reason says dozens of immigrants have been walking through these doors or telephoning nonstop since ICE staged its first major raid in the Boston area in the spring.
Every day of the week, ICE was around here, Commonwealth, Linden Street. So people was calling us and say, ICE is here. We see a car. So people was very stressed. Every time they were seeing a black car or a car with windows with shade, there was a stress.
Sinvalda Oliveira of Marlboro, an esthetician, says that's bad for business and morale.
We're going to all go broke because our client is gone. All the bakeries, all the markets, because now we're not making enough money to pay our employees. It's crazy. It's horrible. It's not right.
Oliveira is a naturalized U.S. citizen and says these deportations are not what she expected when she voted for Donald Trump. She's not alone. Like her, local Brazilians lean conservative as a community, according to researchers who cite evangelical Christian belief as a major factor.
I was raised with very conscious family values, religion.
She says that's why she also supported former right-wing Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro, who professes to be a religious man.
I vote for Bolsonaro because of that, and I vote for Trump because of that, too.
But now she's changing her mind. She says she may sit out the next U.S. presidential election altogether.
If the things is still going sour, I'm going to skip it. I'm not going to vote at all because I don't want to be part of that. It's not normal. We cannot leave afraid.
Taylor Boas, a Boston University Latin American expert, says many other Brazilians, like Latino voters broadly speaking, are also having second thoughts about what they believe.
Things are changing. We've known for a long time that immigration has been an issue, but using ICE aggressively to round people up off the streets is something new. And so, people's attitudes are evolving.
Not everyone. Some Brazilians have been unswayed politically by the targeting of their community by federal agents acting under the direction of President Trump. Heloisa Maria Gaval of the nonprofit Brazil Women's Group in Brighton says she's seen it up close.
We had a man who was deported to Brazil. He has six kids born in the United States. he was campaigning for Trump. And I was getting messages on social media of people saying, why are you helping him? He voted for Trump. And I said, I don't care if he voted for Trump. He is a human being and he needs help right now.
Others say they are too stressed with daily pressures to worry about politics. Take this woman GBH News met in August, who was waiting anxiously at the Brazilian Workers Center for a rideshare voucher for a one-way trip to Logan Airport. Her husband was arrested months ago and is sitting in an ICE detention center in Louisiana. She says she wants to avoid the same fate for her and her children. And what happened to your husband?
Migração pegou, tá preso.
The immigration detained him.
Tem desespero, desespero total. Os meninos só choram, com medo.
I was terrified, my kids just crying because they are afraid.
The airplane carrying her and her children landed in Belo Horizonte 18 hours after leaving Logan. Upon arrival, she spoke to a freelance reporter in collaboration with GBH about her concerns. I don't know what I'm going to do now. I'm sort of lost, she said. I left there kind of lost, and I arrived here kind of lost. As ICE launches new raids, it's likely many more Brazilians will be leaving like this woman or retreating into the shadows. For The World, I'm Philip Martin, Boston.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out our original reporting on YouTube. That's also where you can subscribe to our new channel. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Please join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Bill Resnick, Ron Cuniff, Deet and Paul Meserve, Patrice F. and Cameron J., Merle Kurtzrock and George Zimmerman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.